Going through a divorce is daunting and can make you feel financially vulnerable. Ampla Finance can help. Unlike other loans, there's no need for any ongoing monthly repayments. You're only charged loan interest on the amount of money used to pay your solicitor's fees as your case progresses, and the easy-to-use online tool keeps you in full control throughout the process. Your loan is normally repaid in full when you reach settlement, so between now and then, you have peace of mind that the cost of your divorce won't impact your day-to-day needs. Ampla Finance puts you at the heart of everything they do and can help you to make the fresh start you're looking for. To find out more, click the link in the podcast description or visit www.amplafinance.com.
Hello and welcome to the Smart Divorce Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about what happens when you have a new relationship with somebody and you want to make sure that you protect your finances. So if you decide to move in with a new partner or even get married for a second or even third time, how can you protect yourself legally? You'll know how hard it is going through divorce and you probably won't want to be in a position where you spend money that you've spent on your divorce proceedings and you want to do what you can to legally protect yourself. I'm going to talk to lawyer Jason Stanley from the Callister Family Law today. He's going to be telling us all about cohabitation agreements, prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements. Let's jump straight in. Hello, and I'm very delighted today to be joined by Jason Stanley. Jason is a partner at McAllister Family Law. I'll let him introduce himself properly. Thank you for joining me today, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm great, and thank you for inviting me. It's a delight to be invited to be a part of this. I'm really excited.
Excellent. Me too. I'm looking forward to our conversation. I think it's going to be incredibly useful to a lot of people. Do you want to just give us a bit of background about sort of what your specialities are and what you've been up to in your career so far?
Of course. I'm sad to say a 20-year plus PQE solicitor. the grey hair and the hairline says it all. I undertake an array of family work for those who are married, contemplating divorce or separating and there are children issues. But latterly, in the last 5-10 years, I focused on the unmarried couple aspect, which I find fascinating. I think is a developing trend that's going to feature more and more as time passes on. I think marriage is on the decline. People are choosing to live together. They may have had a marriage first time round and choose to form a relationship that's not married, and they need to be wary about that. But then also prenuptial agreements are becoming popular. I'm finding more and more instructions on that basis. So I do a mixed bag. I'm sort of a hybrid finance, children, unmarried couple work. I'm a partner at McAllister Family Law, who's part of the Beyond Group. And we're a national and international law firm and can cater for all sorts of clients in those scenarios.
Fantastic. And you're a Manchester-based person.
I am indeed, the big lights of Manchester.
Big lights of the city. And so I should fess up that this podcast came about because we had coffee a couple of weeks ago and started having a conversation about cohabiting, and not you and me cohabiting. and it struck me that it's a topic that we haven't covered a huge amount of, and it felt like it would be something that we should talk about. So a lot of people coming out of divorce have very negative feelings about marriage and about entering into another marital relationship, but lots go relatively quickly into cohabitation, believing that if they'd have cohabited in the first place, that would have put them in a much better position than they were when they were married. And I think it's important to start off by explaining that that's not necessarily the case. And the rules in England and Wales are quite different for cohabiting and married couples, aren't they?
You are absolutely correct. And I feel for those people, particularly if been in a long marriage or may have had children and had a terrible experience and maybe fearful about remarrying again the negative experience or the cost or whatever may influence that, and may choose to go down a route that they perceive is simpler, just simply live with somebody. And that is fraught with some danger because, as you correctly say, the laws that apply to a married couple are completely different to those that apply to an unmarried couple. And in fact, in some instances, if you're unmarried, there isn't an unmarried act of parliament, although there is something in the pipeline that may not come to into good law for years. It's maybe a while off. We're stuck with sort of quite dry property law or trust law that can be a minefield. And so I think it's critical for those couples to get advice quite early from somebody like yourself, financial planner, or somebody like me, get some initial legal advice, because you just need to enter into that second relationship with your eyes wide open, I think, particularly if you're worried about how the first relationship that didn't work out panned out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a misconception that we should also probably stamp on early on in this recording, which is the common law husband and wife.
Yes, there's no such thing. It's a myth. It really is. You can construct your life like a married couple, and that's fine. And maybe it's a tagline, but there is no law. There's no common law man and wife that exists in England and Wales, and it's a misnomer. So people need to be mindful of that. I mean, what's interesting is if you are in a cohabiting relationship and a long, fulfilling one with children and conduct yourselves exactly like a man and wife would, the court can draw inferences from that and see how you've constructed your relationship. And I pause there and emphasize the word constructed, because it's one of the features of unmarried laws that a court will consider constructive trusts as part of their remit when unpicking a separation in an unmarried scenario. It's quite an important feature. So to do away with, I think, a lot of implied or suggestions, it's very unromantic. We discussed this when we had coffee. Maybe they should go and get a lawyer and sort of be honest with their other half and say, well, this is what I'm bringing to the pot, and this is what I foresee our financial relationship should look like, as unromantic as that is, and see what the reaction is.
Absolutely. Can I just ask you about something, but just before we move on? You mentioned constructed trust.
Yes,
well,
I did.
Please tell me more. That's not a phrase I've ever heard and don't know anything about. So,
okay, that's great.
Tell us
Absolutely.
More.
Okay, so if I might be give you a good example of how that might transpire. So say a client, Jill, has bought a house in her sole name. She put the deposit down and she's single. And 2 years later, she meets John and they start living together. John lives in her house. He contributes half towards the mortgage. Maybe they have children together. He puts a loft extension in, landscapes the garden, maybe uses 20 grand of inheritance to pay off some of the mortgage and the rest of it. And then after 15 years of relationship, that comes to an end. Now, at the land registry, Jill is the sole legal owner of that property. So the starting point is she will say, it's my house. Sorry, John. Tough luck. That's how the title is registered. Bye. Yeah. Thanks for the ride. Yeah. So he, in the first instance, has some difficulty because the evidence points to a legal document at land registry that says she's the sole legal and beneficial owner. So on the title deed, she's the legal owner, but she also owns the property, the beneficial interest. And so what John might do in that scenario is to say, okay, well, there's a reason why I'm not on the deeds. And the first one is because it was your house when you bought it in your own right. And I happened to subsequently move in with you. So he would say she holds the legal title solely as hers, but on trust, on a constructive trust for him. And he might say, I invite the court to have regard to how our relationship was constructed. I have lived almost like your husband. I've made financial contribution that's not minimal. Our wealth has been blended. We've had children together. They may have done mirror wills. So for instance, if Jill passed away, she may have nominated John to be the guardian and beneficiary of her estate that would advance his case. They may have been engaged to marry. And all these bits and pieces of information, the court gets a feel for how do they construct their relationship. You know, it may be very different. They may not blend their finances. It may be very much mine and yours and very spreadsheet-like. And again, that may have some resonance. So that's a typical silly example, but a palatable one for your listeners to understand that that is how that might pan out. But it's tricky because it's the quality of the evidence. You know, say there's no documentary evidence to support that. It's all on John say-so. He might have a good case, but the burden of proof is on him to try and convince the court that the land registry is wrong and actually it's a 50-50 or a 60-40 or whatever he wants to argue. It's going to involve a lot of legal cost if Jill's going to stand firm on that. So a better option would have been when John moved in for them to think about putting him on the deeds or enter into a deed of trust or draw up some kind of cohabitation agreement, for instance, saying this is what we both agree our financial landscape is like, particularly if you maybe have children, you know, something monumental on the horizon. So I hope that gives you a brief overview. It wasn't too boring, too dry for your listeners, but that's the kind of example.
No, I think that's really helpful. It strikes me, you know, you mentioned about kind of putting arguments to the court. And I know in a marriage situation, in a divorce or dissolution of a civil partnership, we're obviously trying to avoid going down the court route and trying to settle things in a non-court way, if at all possible. It sounds to me that in these sorts of situations where it's cohabitation rather than a marriage or civil partnership, that court is the only option to get this resolved. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. Although okay. I'm glad you've brought this up because, again, when we talked early on about the differences between married and unmarried law, if you're unmarried and you can't reach a resolution and you do have to issue proceedings and have recourse to the court, the civil procedure rules do apply. And what that means is that there will be de facto a winning party and a losing party. So in our scenario of Jill and John, if Jill won't do anything and John takes her to court and he wins and he gets an order for sale to get some of the equity out of the house, he's won his case. So say his legal costs, just for an example, are £25,000 and hers are similar. If Jill's lost that case, she not only incurs her own costs, but the court is likely to make an order that she picks up the majority of John's costs. So she may be on the hook for 50K's worth of costs. And so there's double jeopardy. And so you may say that sounds quite archaic or difficult, but it's actually a mechanism to weed out the weak cases. Quite a lot of my cohabitation disputes don't go to litigation because it's pretty straightforward at the outset. There's no evidence or it's straightforward. It's quite rare for them to go to court. And one of the big considerations is legal costs. Do you really want to lose, which would be horrific, and then have the indignity and the psychology and the financial ruination of having to pay your opponent's costs? It's grim. So you go to court as a last resort, and you mentioned other options. You should try and mediate outside of court if you can, if the issues are narrow. You could try a solicitor's negotiation. You could try and negotiate yourself. But I found that when I have issued claims in the civil courts, quite early on at the first hearing, the judge, and it seems to be a trend certainly in the North, the judges tend to stand them down and to order the parties to at least attempt a mediation or something called an ADR, alternate dispute resolution, because there's sort of two schools of thought as to why that might be useful. One is that the court system is just so clogged and trying to get hearings is becoming harder and harder. And there are a lot of litigated cases and stretches on the resources of the court system. So trying to resolve it outside of court might result in a resolution quicker. So that's a real positive. But secondly, also, you know, some of your other guests that have been on have sort of argued for the fact that ADR or mediation, you get the sole focus of the person running the arbitration or the mediation concentrating on your case and giving you full attention rather than a court that may have three or four cases in the list and get presented with documents right at the 11th hour, may not read everything, and it's a bit of a rush job. So there are pluses and minuses. The problem with the mediation, the ADR, is it's privately paying. So the parties would be expected to try and contribute half to the expert fee, may range between £1,000 to £2,500 each, to try and get a day with a mediator to try and settle the case. And I think if your issues are quite narrow, it's good money well spent. It's cheaper than court. So that's another option available to parties. And as I say, lawyers come with a bad reputation. Litigation is the last resort. It really is, because it's stressful and it's so expensive.
Yeah, and long. That's the other thing.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. I mean, crikey. We find it, you know, we used to sort of say a case be done in 6 to 12 months. We're 12 to 18 now, easily, particularly down south as well.
Cohabitation agreements. So you mentioned this before. Mm-hmm. And you said about you can kind of document the landscape. I'm thinking of John and Jill, who will forever be in my heart.
Good.
If in your example, you know, it was Jill's house in the first place, and okay, albeit John started paying half the mortgage, but then he contributed the loft extension in your example and landscaped the garden. I was listening.
Yeah, very good, very good.
Attention to the house will have changed kind of post-cohabitation. Is the cohabitation agreement, I guess we should start with what it is and what it sets out in the first place, but also is it something that should be reviewed regularly, like a will, for example?
Brilliant question, and you're absolutely right. So you'd start off with the document being a starter for 10. This is how things exist. And typically you might say that if something massive on the financial landscape happens, like he contributes X amount to paying off the mortgage or pays for the loft, that might be the genesis to formulating a cohabitation agreement. So you may say, well, look, from the day John moves in, what was mine? So this is Jill. What was mine beforehand? So my, I don't know, 50 grand deposit on the house is mine if we ever sell it, or God forbid, separate. But anything thereafter, when he moves in, because he's paying the mortgage and the price of the house goes up and the mortgage is reduced, is shared equally. That might be a very democratic way of approaching this. So both parties win. Jill gets her initial deposit ring fence, shall we say, and he gets his contribution to the house fairly reflected. And it may be a little bit more prescriptive. So maybe they have different salaries. So John contributes £1,000 to bills and mortgage, but Jill pays a bit more. They may be fine by that. And then you mentioned the review clause, and it's a cracking question, because it's very similar to prenuptial agreements. It's sensible to have a review for a couple of reasons. One, if there's a major change, so maybe a baby being born, or an inheritance, or I don't know, an accident where one party can't work for a period of time, claiming benefits. So that might trigger a review. Or you might just have sort of a review once every 3 or 5 years, just to sort of update it. And you don't have to spend a lot of legal costs. It's just a variation to say, you know, if this relationship now has long legs, it may be a softening of position. So if Jill and John have been together for 15 years, she may not be that bothered about a 50 grand deposit. She may say, look, we've invested in each other a long time and we've got 3 kids. What's yours is mine. And let's just do a straight 50-50. That could be their choice. So it's a contract. It's a contractual document. Just like if I sold you my pen for 10p, we enter into a contract. It's the same. It's the same concept. And you can vary that by way of consent.
Okay. I like that. That's interesting.
Cool.
I've been working with a client. I'll be careful how I describe it and leave it loose so that nobody recognises this person. But they've got an arrangement. They've moved in with their new partner. They're currently going through a divorce and ending their actual marriage. They're living with a new partner, and the house belongs to the new partner. And they're not contributing to the mortgage, but they are buying all the food for the house and contributing to the bills. And this is a position that kind of concerns me as their financial planner, because I feel like there's you're not actually paying towards the mortgage. So if this relationship goes wrong in the future, there's going to be no kind of you contributed to that, but actually they are making a contribution to the household as a whole. What position would that put them in?
It's tricky because it's discretionary, but I think what you're really getting at is, let's just say the less wealthy of the two is making those contributions. I mean, it's not material. Is it enhancing and enriching the asset? No. It seems to be a way of meeting cost of living. You know, so I sort of take the weaker party out of the equation. They would have to pay rent or mortgage if they were living on their own, and they're paying far less than that. So are they actually enhancing? It's all to do with the property. Again, because you're unmarried, it's very proprietary. It's all about property. It's very narrow. You know, in the Matrimonial Causes Act, as you know, the court's got to look at fairness, reasonableness, or needs. And it just doesn't apply in this scenario. So, if you were a generous person, so you're the wealthier one in that scenario, and you really want to recognize somebody's contribution as being valid, or you can't survive without that, you may throw them a bone and say, okay, you've earned a bit of an interest, but it's subsistence contribution, I think. It's got to really be meaty. Like, that's why I picked on a loft extension, paying off a mortgage, or enhancing or enriching that asset. It's got to be tangible. I mean, again, I mentioned constructive trust as the popular way in which people who are unmarried may run a contested case. There's something else called a resulting trust, which is less popular these days. And it's sort of a tabulation of John has contributed and he lists the things that he's done and then says, I want them back because I've paid X, Y, and Z. And nominal contributions to like food or, I don't know, a vacation or holiday aren't going to cut any ice. It's got to be, here's materials, building works, landscape fees that he has contributed, and he sort of tots them up. Courts aren't that interested in that anymore. They're trying to be a little bit more modern and look at it as a family whole, as an entity. It's a tricky one. I do get what you're saying, but it depends on the couple, you know, and their choice, I guess. It's up to them. This is delicate, isn't it? Because you're talking about how you construct your finances in a loving, committed, new, happy relationship. And it may be unpalatable, you know. It depends on what the people are like, I guess.
It's hard, isn't it? Because people in our positions, the relationships go wrong every day.
Absolutely.
And you don't want to be, as you said before, unromantic and go, yeah, but you really need to go and see a family lawyer and get a cohabitation agreement put in place to protect you later.
I've got a great tip, which is when the wealthier party wants to protect something, instead of saying, when we separate, we'll get X, that's very negative. What you might just say is, if we ever sell the house, you know, that's got a nice ring to it. There's no sort of doom and gloom about it, because that's usually what it is going to happen. I mean, people might be quite blunt about it, but it just starts a conversation. Because if you're the wealthier person, you've got everything to lose. If you're the not so wealthy person, you kind of also need to know where you stand. And it's about just having that honesty. You know, it surprises me that people aren't more open about this, I think, because it's like any decision that's huge on the financial line. You know, you'd do your research and you'd be honest with the person you're, you know, getting involved with. What are the rules? What are we doing? Who's contributing what? Who gets what? How are we going to do it? You know, if things don't work out, I don't understand what's such a big deal about that, to be honest. But there you go.
It's money. We don't talk about money.
Yeah, we're British.
We're British, exactly.
That's right.
We were talking to someone about this just yesterday. You know, we'll happily sit in the pub and talk about our sex lives, but we're not going to talk about what we earn or what we've got in the bank.
Yep.
It's a very strange, very strange country we live in. Let's move on to another example, because I know particularly when we're talking about cohabitation, the buying of property has a real impact on how we decide to buy property together. So I guess there's two things. There's how the property is registered, whether it's jointly or tenants in common, and also what about if one party's putting in a considerably higher deposit than the other party?
Again, great example. So just for your listeners who may or may not know, if you are joint tenants, two people own an asset. So if one of the parties passes away, the entire property goes to the survivor. That's how husband and wives tend to owner to a same-sex couple. But that can apply in unmarried. It can even apply to people who are just friends or sister and brother. It doesn't have to be in a marriage or unmarried context. So that's one example. Another one is tenants in common that you mentioned, and that is a specific share. So again, Jill and John in our scenario, Jill puts down 50 grand and John puts down 25 grand or so, a lesser sum. What they may say is we don't hold the property, although we're both on the title deeds as joint owners, she has a higher proportion of the property than he does. So they own it in unequal shares. So you can stipulate when you buy the property on the transfer deed how you hold it. Or another example might be it's held at land registry jointly, but they enter into something called a deed of trust. So for example, actually that's not quite right. If say John's got bad credit rating, that's a better example. They both want to own the property in joint names, but he's got poor credit rating. He can't get a mortgage, but he can pay towards the mortgage and the like. He's got a good job. It's just, I don't know, came out in that IVA recently, let's just say. So Jill is the sole legal owner, but she holds it on trust for John as to 50-50. So they may end up drafting a deed of trust to say she's the legal owner, but if they ever sold it, half's his and half's hers. So those are some options. It's sensible to speak to a conveyance. And actually, conveyancers will often ask people to fill out questionnaires. How do you want to hold the property? Tenants in common, joint tenants, sole, deed of trust. This is how you're going to register at land registry. And if there's ever a dispute that I'm involved with, for cohabitees, the first thing you do is get the conveyancing file. Because what you've got to establish right at the outset is when they bought the house, what did they intend? What was the instruction? It's critical because it's the bedrock of the case. Of course, things can change over time. The starting point is how did they intend to buy it? So it's crucial that they get good advice, particularly if there's an unequal contribution. It's really, really important because it's, as you say, it has ramifications if things don't go right. And just because you're happily in love and you've got this new relationship, it can cloud judgment. Nobody's thinking about, oh gosh, what happens if? Get your house in order, sensible. I think it's fair as well, because then it just sets the tone.
No, absolutely. I think it might be useful just to touch on pensions, because this is very, very different for cohabiting couples compared with those in a marriage or civil partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everything goes into the pot in the marriage. The Matrimony Causes Act is wide-ranging. All resources in a marriage are considered, whatever their provenance. So even if an inheritance comes in, the court potentially has quite wide jurisdiction to consider an inheritance like a non-matrimonial asset and pull it into the pot if needs can't be met. So in a marriage context, you know, the court has really wide powers, but in unmarried ones, boy, you're struggling. You know, each party is going to keep their own pension. Each party is going to keep their own things. Each party is going to keep their own savings or investments. It's very much how you legally own that particular asset or bank account or ISA or Ferrari. The fairness element simply
that fairness element, as an example.
Being dramatic. The fairness element just doesn't come into it. And that's why it's important to perhaps list what is yours and what is mine. We do this a lot in prenuptial agreements, postnuptial agreements. We actually have a schedule at the back saying this is what constitutes my property. And you will list my bank account, my pension, my SIP, my car, my Rolex, whatever it is. So you ring fence or identify at a point in time what is hers or his and vice versa. And then anything you create together, you may say, let's share. It's quite democratic.
Okay. So as we've brought those into the conversation, it would be it would be useful to mention prenuptial and postnuptial agreements, because these can be particularly useful if you do decide to enter into a second marriage, for example, rather than cohabiting. Because I guess people tend to have more assets the second time around than perhaps they did when they were starting out, if they were marrying in their early 20s, for example, that it might not have been a consideration, but, you know, 20 years down the line, may well have assets that you want to make sure are set out in the first place. So can you tell us a bit about what prenup is, what postnup is, how they work, what sort of things they say?
Of course. But before I answer that question, I'm going to be the questioner for a second. Are you finding instructions on a prenup or a postnup basis? Are you finding, just out of interest, a trend that these are becoming more popular? Are you being asked to advise on them?
Not a huge amount, not really? As much as I would like. We quite often advise clients to seek legal advice if there are assets that they have in place already and they're planning on a second marriage. I'm sending more people for cohabitation agreements.
Oh, okay.
because of everything that we've discussed already.
Yeah, yeah.
More and more people who come out of a marriage think that they did the wrong thing by getting married, and actually when they come and see a family solicitor to talk about a cohabitation agreement, they might realize that things aren't so bad when you're married after all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're finding that it's becoming more popular, I have to say, which is refreshing for the reasons we discussed, that sort of second blended family particular. But to answer your question, there's two types of nuptial agreements. It's a contract. There's prenup, so for those who are contemplating marriage, and you can only enter one if you know that you're going to get married. If marriage isn't on the horizon, then it's a cohabitation agreement. There's no fixed date to get married. And there's a few rules about this. You need to agreed your document and have it signed off less than a month before the wedding. It's really designed to be a cooling off thing. But you'd be amazed. Some people sort of ring two nights before the wedding saying, can have a prenup. And you're going, really? And that's just a car crash, because there's nothing worse than a rush job. It just won't be binding in any sense of the fashion. So you may say to that person, look, enjoy your wedding and your honeymoon. Come to see somebody like me and we'll do a postnup. So we'll enter into exactly the same document, except it's called a postnup because it's signed and dated and executed after the wedding. And that's the only difference between the two. One's before and one's after. The risk of waiting and doing a postnup is once you're married, the person might not want to do a postnup. They may say, well, you're married now. So there's a bit of a risk, and that's why people sort of hedge their bets and say, let's have an honest conversation before. And it's usually for those couples where there's a huge imbalance in wealth contribution. So, yeah. I don't know, Jill in this scenario brings 2 million quid to the relationship and John brings nothing. And she might think, boy, is he marrying me just for my money? The minute we get married, the marriage rules apply, fairness and everything else we talked about would be applicable. So what she might do to try and ward against that is to invite John to voluntarily agree to enter into a contract, the prenup. And that's what it is, it's a contract. And we often get asked, very, very often, are they binding? And the answer to that is not an easy yes or no answer. The answer to that is, it's a contract, just like me selling you a pen. It's a contract. But there's certain rules and
I don't
boundaries.
Want to buy a pen, though.
Please have my pen. I want to sell you a pen. There's certain boundaries and rules. Usually, both parties should get independent legal advice because it's a complicated, very, very important document. And the weaker financial party usually needs to understand what it is that they potentially are giving up, or what is the wealthier party preserving. Do they understand that? It's going to mean that the document is upheld by a court later on down the line if both parties had legal advice. Is the quality of the disclosure good? So does John know that Jill's actually got 2 million quid? It may be that she's got 4 million quid and she's not telling him the true extent of her wealth. So the disclosure must be transparent. He needs to know what he's giving up, or he needs to see a declaration from her with some supporting evidence of, here's my property portfolio, or here's my savings or trust fund or whatever it is, so that he knows and goes into this arrangement eyes wide open. And then there's sort of got to be an element of fairness about it, I suppose. I recently took an instruction, and again, no names, but it's super wealthy. You're talking 40 million in this relationship. And when we got the draft, I think less than 1% had been offered to the weaker financial party in the event of a breakdown 20 years down the line. And that's just blatantly unfair. If someone's given 20 years of their life to a marriage, there's no ways on earth a court is going to say 1% is going to that weaker party. Even if they didn't earn it, the court's going to adopt an element of fairness. So you've got to carefully think about a pre or a post-nup about, not fairness is an important word, but you've got to almost crystal ball gaze and do a cross check about what would a judge do if he was presented with this prenuptial agreement 20 years down the line. And it goes back to that review point you made a few minutes ago. Prenups or post-nups should be reviewed perhaps once every 3 or 5 years, or a major change like a child. I mean, you know, you think about it, Jill and John, and she's got 2 million quid and he brings nothing, and then they have a child 2 years later, it changes the whole landscape of that agreement completely, because all of a sudden there's a new human being to factor in. You know, he needs a house. John will need a house to share care of that child, as will Jill, and he might not have enough. So it's that kind of thing that has to be thought about, and you don't have to spend a fortune on this at all. If you get proper legal advice from somebody like you to think about what kind of financial consideration should I have, it's not just about a house and income, it's other things, pensions, savings, investments, trying to future-proof, and then get some advice from a lawyer. It's much cheaper than litigating and having a huge bun fight at the end of the process.
Absolutely. Totally agree with that. A couple of things that have struck me about what you said. You mentioned independent legal advice for nuptial agreements. Does the same apply to a cohabitation agreement?
Absolutely. So again, think about what a judge might do. So if you go to court and one party tries to uphold the cohab agreement to say, but this is what John agreed to, one of the defences that she's going to have is John knew what he was signing up to because Joe Blogg's solicitor corresponded with me. Here's some of the letters on an open basis. There's the solicitor's signature and perhaps advisor's certificate annexed to the document. And John knew exactly what he was doing because he had specialist legal advice. And so if I'm ever instructed to help protect the wealth of the wealthy party, I'm almost saying to them, look, John needs legal advice, and if he hasn't got any money, you might offer to contribute to his solicitor so that he gets completely independent legal advice. Even if you don't like the reply and the negotiation that may flow from it, at least then there's that clear piece of evidence that this person knew what they were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. We were talking off air before we started about somebody that I've spoken to in the last week who approached me and said that they had a prenup in place and that they had taken independent legal advice. Well, they hadn't taken it. They had received independent legal advice from a fantastic solicitor in our great city and had ignored the independent legal advice that was given to them because they just decided they would just sign the nuptial agreement because nothing was ever going to go wrong with this relationship. And independent legal advice is there for the protection of both parties, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And isn't there to make sure that you've got a whole load of extra costs at the stage of putting these in place. I wonder if you could just talk for a second about that. The importance of actually taking notice of the advice you're given.
Definitely, because certainly on a pre or a post-nup, I mean, that solicitor is going to have to put his or her signature to an advisor's certificate, which sort of might fill that person with dread, because in 10 or 15 years' time, if that document is before a judge who has to review the quality of the document and decide if it should be upheld or varied or not, the first thing the judge is probably going to look at is the appendices. What were the schedules and did they get independent legal advice? And the solicitor will set out in a palatable letter to either the wealthy party, if that's who they act for, or the non-wealthy party, the ramifications for each of the provisions in the document. So this is what this means. you are giving up X amount of your wealth for John over this period of time. Are you content with that? And do you understand that you're going to have to honor that? Or from John's point of view, you do realize that you should really be going for more because it's blatantly unfair. Or there may be a clause that says, I've seen these before, if things don't work out after 5 years, I'll buy you a one-up, one-down. If they don't work out after 10 years, you might get a semi. If they don't work out after 20 years, I might buy you a... It's very prescriptive, and you're just thinking, wow, who can predict the financial landscape, the credit crunch and all sorts of stuff. So getting that independent legal advice might be the difference between an awful lot of money being saved if you're the wealthier party or gained if you're the not-so-wealthy party. So it's crucial. And also these contracts, frankly, are really dry and dull and littered with acts of parliament and definitions. And it's not easy to navigate. They are typically 20 pages plus long for a straightforward one. And so I think it is money well spent just to invest, because it's your future, for hopefully till the day you die. And just on that point, it's not just confined to the prenup, by the way. You mentioned it before. If I did get a prenup, I'd want to know, how do they hold the property? Because the prenup document has to mirror how they're going to hold their family home or property portfolio. It also then leads me to think about what are they doing in the case of a will, which is another separate legal document, not just about the prenup. Does the will mirror what the intention is behind how they're going to hold property or construct their finances? Because you really want your property, your prenup, and your will to be singing from the same song sheet. Because if they're not, they're going to be there's going to be tension, because the will might say X and completely contradict what the prenup says. So it's broader than just singularly zoning on the document. You've got to really look at the wider landscape. And people might not have even thought about the property or the wills. So that's in itself another reason to get some independent advice.
Yeah, absolutely. This is such an important subject. And I think it's something that more and more people should be considering. And it's still not as wide as I would hope for. It's like having some, we talk to our clients about financial protection, life insurance, critical illness cover, income protection. You have these insurances and you hope that you'll never need them. And to me, a nuptial agreement is just the same sort of a thing.
100%. I agree with you. And it's grisly and grim to think about life insurance, prenups or wills. But frankly, once they're done, then you can just park them and stick them in the safe or on your hard drive or whatever. And then you can forget about it and the hard work's done. So you may as well do them all at the same time as well. Sort of get your hit from lawyers all in one go and financial advisors and then park it, and then you can get on with your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. These are the things that you hope you never need. But if you do need, you're going to be very, very glad that you got them in place at the time. Jason, we're coming to the end of our time together, believe it or not. It's really flown. I guess lastly, is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't that you feel that would be worthwhile to add?
I think it was sort of just to elaborate on that last point. Getting a will if you're unmarried is important too, because particularly if you're in a blended family, that sort of coming out of a marriage or relationship, having children with your ex-husband or wife and starting a new relationship, if you don't do a will, you're creating havoc. Because there's going to be an expectation for your adult children to maybe make some financial provision for you. What about your new partner? You may say that I don't mind my new partner living in our house till he or she passes away, and then it reverts to my children. You may have stepchildren who are adults competing for that as well. So I think it's as important to speak to a matrimonial solicitor or somebody who practices this area of law as much as it is to deal with a wills and probate solicitor, just to make sure that you're not leaving a legacy of financial pain and uncertainty for those that you leave behind. And it's dead easy to a few hundred quid, and you can update it anytime you want. The amount of disputes I'm seeing, because I do contested probate as well, starting to develop that practice, It's mind-blowing how wills that haven't been updated for 20 years or not even exist, and you're just leaving, as I say, carnage for those you leave behind. But that was it on that happy note.
No, I totally agree with that. I remember a situation which happened to a friend of mine, and their mother had died, and they had gained a stepmother, and their dad had sadly passed away afterwards, and he was in the solicitor's office the day following his father's death, wanting to contest the will because it was all everything from both his parents was going to end up with stepmom, and as you say, it creates carnage and havoc, and at a time when you should be grieving, not sitting in the solicitor's office.
Well, you're absolutely right. And my two litigated cases, I've only got two in litigation at the moment, are both surviving spouses where the deceased has not made provision in the will for their surviving spouse. It's unreal. It's just unreal. So, yeah, really, get some advice
really
early.
Tricky. Fantastic. Brilliant.
Well, thank you. That was a really my first podcast as well. So thank you for being gentle.
Oh, well, congratulations. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. And we will see you in the next episode. Hi, and I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Smart Divorce Podcast. If you would like to get in touch, please have a look in the show notes for our details, or go onto the website www.smartdivorce.co.uk. Also, if you are listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify and you wouldn't mind leaving us a lovely 5-star review, that would be fantastic. I know that lots of our listeners are finding this is incredibly helpful in their journey through separation, divorce, and dissolving a civil partnership. Also, if you would like some further support, we do have a Facebook group now. It's called Separation, Divorce, and Dissolution UK. Please do go on to Facebook, search up the group, and we'd be delighted to have you join us. The one thing I would say is do please answer their membership questions. Okay, have a great day and take care.